1. Introduction. Now we come to a key concept which is extremely important for understanding both the religious and the secular outlook of contemporary man. This idea is an extremely complex one, and here we can give only a sketchy outline of the problems involved in this question. Charles Darwin's Origin of Species came out in 1859, was instantly accepted by many people, and soon became very popular. People such as Thomas Henry Huxley and Herbert Spencer in England, together with Ernst Haeckel in Germany, author of The Riddle of the Universe, 1899, and others, popularized the ideas of Darwin and made evolution the very center of their philosophy. It seems to explain everything. Of course, people like Nietzsche picked it up and used it for their so-called spiritual prophecies. Thus, the people who were in the main school of Western thought, which was rationalism carried as far as you can take it, accepted evolution. To the present day, one can say that evolution is a central dogma of advanced, under quotation marks, thinkers, of people who are in harmony with the times. From the very beginning, however, there were people who were arguing about this. In the time of Darwin, there was a Catholic thinker, St. George Jackson Mivart, author of On the Genesis of Species, 1871, who believed in evolution but not in Darwin's idea of natural selection, which reduced Darwin to despair because the latter discovered that his idea could not be proved. Especially in the last 10 to 30 years, there have come out many critical accounts of evolution from an objective point of view. As these works demonstrate, most of the books supporting evolution begin with certain premises and assumptions arising from the naturalistic outlook. Now there is even a society in San Diego called the Institute for Creation Research, which has come out with several good books. They themselves are religious, but they have several books which discuss evolution quite objectively, not at all from a religious standpoint. They say there are two models for understanding the universe. One is the evolution model, and another is the creation model. They take the evidence of the history of the Earth, for example the geological layers and so forth, and they try to see which model it fits. They have discovered that fewer adjustments have to be made if one follows the model of creation, if there was a God who created things in the beginning, and if the Earth is not billions of years old, but only some thousands of years old. The evolutionary model, on the other hand, requires a good many corrections. In this regard, it can be compared to the old model of the Ptolemaic universe, versus the Copernican model. Footnote: the Ptolemaic model held that the Sun and planets revolve around the Earth. It was replaced by the Copernican model, which holds that the Earth and planets revolve around the Sun. End of footnote. Like the Ptolemaic model, the evolutionary model is now proving quite cumbersome. Some members of this institute travel around to various universities. In the last year or two, they have held several debates before thousands of spectators at universities in Tennessee, Texas, etc. Interest has been quite high. Those defending evolution have not been able to give sound evidence in support of it and, in fact, on several points were caught on their ignorance of recent discoveries in paleontology. There are very sophisticated and knowledgeable people defending both points of view. Here we will not even discuss the question of atheistic evolution because it is obviously a philosophy of fools. Footnote: Psalm 13:1, the fool hath said in his heart there is no God. End of footnote. Of people who can believe, as Huxley said, that if you put a group of monkeys together with typewriters they will eventually give you the Encyclopedia Britannica, given enough time, if not millions then billions of years, according to the laws of chance. Someone calculated evolutionary theory according to the laws of chance and found that in fact such a thing would never happen. Anyone who can believe that, can believe anything. The more serious dispute is between theistic evolution, that God created the world and then it evolved, and the Christian point of view. Here we must say that the fundamentalist point of view is incorrect in many instances because the fundamentalists do not know how to interpret Scripture. They say, for example, that the book of Genesis must be understood literally, and one cannot do this. The Holy Fathers tell us which parts are literal and which parts are not. The first misunderstanding that must be cleared away before even discussing this question is one that causes many people to miss the point, and that is that we must distinguish between evolution and variation. Variation is the process by which people make various hybrids of peas, different breeds of cats, etc. After 50 years of experimentation, for example, they came up with a new breed of cat, a combination of Siamese and Persian, called the Himalayan cat, which has long hair like a Persian with the coloring of a Siamese. At first this had happened accidentally, but the cat was never able to reproduce itself purely, and only now after all these years of experimentation have they come up with a new breed which breeds true. Likewise, there are different breeds of dogs, different varieties of plants, and the very races of men are all quite different: pygmies, Hottentots, Chinese, Northern Europeans, all different types of human beings who came from one ancestor. Therefore, the question of variation is one thing, and must be distinguished from evolution. Footnote. In his notes, Father Seraphim writes, "The popular mind accepts mere variation as a proof of a much bigger question of evolution. We leave it to scientists to define the limits of change observable to them. By its grandiose conception, evolution as such cannot be proved by the small variations observable by science today. Let scientists define the limits of variation, and let them use the word and concept of evolution in explaining change, but let them abandon metaphysical schemes which strive to extrapolate small changes into an all-encompassing principle. If this latter is true, let it come naturally from the data without forcing an interpretation on facts." End of footnote. There are undoubtedly many variations within one kind of creature, but these variations never produce anything new, they only produce a different variety of dog or cat or bin or people. In fact, this is more of a proof against evolution than for it, because no one has ever been able to come up with a new kind of creature. The different species, and this term is itself quite arbitrary, for the most part are not able to bear offspring with each other, and, in the few cases where they can, the offspring is not able to reproduce itself. Thus, Saint Ambrose of Milan says, "This is an example to you, O man, to stop meddling in the ways of God." God means for each creature to be separate. 2. Historical background. During the period of the Enlightenment, the worldview was quite stable. Just before this time, the Anglican Archbishop Usher of Armagh calculated all the years given in the Old Testament genealogies and came up with the idea that the world was created in the year of 4004 BC. Footnote: the Archbishop's finding was published in 1650 and was soon added as a marginal notation to the Book of Genesis in the Authorized Version of the Bible. His calculation was based on the Masoteric, Hebrew, text of the Old Testament. According to the Old Testament chronology in the Septuagint, Greek, text, which is used by Orthodox Christians, the earth is approximately 1,500 years older than Archbishop Usher's calculation. End of footnote. Newton believed this, and the Enlightened worldview was in favor of the idea that God created the world in 6 days and then left it to develop itself, and that all the species were just as we see them today. The scientists of that time accepted that. At the end of the period of Enlightenment, however, as the revolutionary fever began to come on, this very stable worldview began to break down, and already some scientists were coming up with more radical theories. At the end of the 18th century, Erasmus Darwin, the grandfather of Charles Darwin, had already come up with the hypothesis that all of life comes from one primordial filament, which is exactly what is meant today by the theory of evolution. Footnote: Erasmus Darwin's book Zoonomia, in which he proposed theory, was published in 1794. End of footnote. His theory did not concern only one species or kind of creature, but proposed that a primordial blob or filament developed into all the different kinds of creatures by transmutations. Would it be too bold, he asked, to imagine that in the great length of time since the earth began to exist, perhaps millions of ages before the history of mankind, would it be too bold to imagine that all warm-blooded animals have arisen from one filament? This new explanation of Erasmus Darwin was an attempt to continue the spirit of the Enlightenment as utter rationalism and simplicity. As rationalism entered deeper into the mind, it was simpler, he thought, to explain life as coming from a single living filament than to give more complicated explanation that God gave being all at once to all different kinds of creatures. Footnote. The term Darwinism was first applied to Erasmus Darwin's theories about evolution, which included natural selection. These theories contributed much to the ideas of his grandson Charles, although the latter never acknowledged the debt. End of footnote. There was one naturalist, Chevalier de Lamarck, author of Philosophie Zoologique 1809, who had a definite evolutionary theory just after this, but he had the idea that the changes necessary to account for the evolving of one species into another were due to the inheritance of acquired characteristics. This could never be proved, and has in fact been quite disproved. Hence the idea of evolution did not take hold. There was, however, one important geologist at this period of the early 19th century who gave a great impetus towards the acceptance of this idea of evolution. This was Charles Lyell, who in 1830 came up with the theory of uniformitarianism, that is, that all we see in the Earth today is due not to catastrophes, to a sudden flood or something similar, but rather to the fact that the processes of operating today have been operating in the past ages, from the beginning of the world, as far back as we can see. Therefore, if we look at the Grand Canyon, we see that the river has been eating away the canyon, and we can calculate, by taking into account how fast the water flows, how much water there is in it now, the quality of the soil and so on, how long it must have taken to wear away the canyon. Lyell thought that if we assume that these processes were always going on at the same rate, this being very rational and given to calculation, we can come up with a uniform explanation of things. In his book Principles of Geology, Lyell wrote, "No causes whatever have from the earliest time to which we can look back, to the present, ever acted but those now acting, and they have never acted with different degrees of energy from which they now exert." Of course, there is no proof of this, this is merely his hypothesis. Footnote. In 1831, a year after Lyell's Principles of Geology was published, Darwin read it during his voyage on the Beagle. After the voyage, Lyell became Darwin's mentor, and it is clear from Darwin's later statements that Lyell's ideas made him think of applying the principles of uniformitarianism to the past history of living creatures. In his private letters, Lyell made it clear that he was intent upon abolishing what he called mosaic geology, that is, interpreting the geologic strata in terms of the Genesis flood. Henry Morris writes, "It is worth noting that neither Darwin nor Lyell were trained as scientists in the modern sense. Darwin was an apostate divinity student whose only degree was in theology. Charles Lyell was trained as a lawyer, not as a geologist. The leading geologist of his day, Cuvier, Buckland, for example, believed in catastrophism, and many of the geologists of our own day are now returning to that view." Lyell must have known that the actual data of geology predominantly favored catastrophism, not uniformitarianism. Yet he dogmatically insisted on long ages and uniformity, sarcastically rejecting the biblical chronology in the process. Morris, The Long War Against God, page 162. Stephen Jay Gould, one of today's leading evolutionists, has actually accused Lyell of deception in his promotion of his system. Lyell relied upon true bits of cunning to establish his uniformitarian view as the only true geology. Lyell imposed his imagination upon the evidence. Gould, Ever Since Darwin, pages 50-149. End of footnote. This idea, together with the idea which was now gaining sympathy, that species evolve one into the other, led to another idea. If you put these two ideas together, you get the idea that most likely the world is not just few thousand years old like Christians seem to say, but that it must be very many thousands or millions of years old, or even more. Thus arose the idea of the greater and greater age of the Earth. But again, this belief, that the world must be very old, was only a presupposition, it was not proved. Already this idea was sinking into the minds of men when in 1859 Charles Darwin came out with his book propounding the idea of natural selection. Darwin's idea was opposed to that of Lamarck, who said that the giraffe evolved because a short-necked creature stretched its neck to eat the higher leaves. Its offspring had a neck an inch longer, the next one stretched a little more, and gradually it became what we know today as a giraffe. This is against all scientific laws, because such things do not happen. An acquired characteristic cannot be inherited. For example, when Chinese women had their feet bound, their daughters were always born with normal feet. Darwin, on the other hand, came up with the idea that there were perhaps two longer-necked creatures which survived because they had longer necks. They were joined together because all the rest died off due to adverse circumstances or disaster, and their offspring did have longer necks because a change had occurred within them, what scientists today call a mutation, under quotation marks. This might have been a chance thing at first, but once reproduction between two such creatures has taken place, it continues down through the ages. Of course, this is a guess because no one has observed such a thing happen. But this guess struck the consciousness of the people. They were like tinder, all ready for it, and this was the spark. The idea sounded so plausible, and the idea of evolution took hold not because it was proved. As a matter of fact, the speculations of Darwin were based almost entirely upon his observations, not of evolution, but of variation. When he was traveling in the Galapagos Islands, Darwin wondered why there were 13 different varieties of one kind of finch, and thought that it was because there was one original variety which had developed according to its environment. This is not evolution but variation. From this, he jumped to the conclusion that if you keep making small changes like that, eventually you will have an absolutely different kind of creature. The problem in trying to prove this scientifically is that no one has ever observed these larger changes. They have only observed changes within a kind. Footnote. This is because, as now been shown through genetic research, the capacity for variation of a particular organism is limited by the inherent variability of that organism's gene pool. In other words, writes Philip E. Johnson, the reason that dogs don't become as big as elephants is not that we just haven't been breeding them long enough. Dogs do not have the genetic capacity for that degree of change, and they stop getting bigger when the genetic limit is reached. Darwin on Trail, page 18. End of footnote. 3. Proofs, under quotation marks, of evolution. Let us look now at the so-called proofs of evolution to see what they are. We are not going to try to disprove, but just to try to see the quality of the proofs that are used, what it is that seems convincing to people who believe in evolution. 1. There is a standard fixed book of zoology used 20 years ago, General Zoology by Tracy I. Storer, which lists a number of proofs. The first proof in the book is called comparative morphology, that is, a comparison of body structures. Man has arms, birds have wings, fish have flippers. The book has convincing diagrams which make them look very much alike. The birds have claws and we have fingers. The book shows how one might have developed into the other. Footnote. In this illustration on page 215 of General Zoology, a hypothetical intermediate, referred to as such in the caption, is shown between the fin of a fish and the limb of an amphibian. In other words, in the absence of an intermediate species, the author had to invent one. End of footnote. All creatures are shown to have a very similar structure, and the different structures are arranged according to different phyla and genera. Of course, this is not a proof. It is very logical, however, to one who believes in evolution. On the other hand, the scientific creationists say that if you believe that God created universe, he must have had a basic master plan of creation. Therefore, all kinds of creatures would have basic similarities. If you believe that God created all the creatures, these diagrams convince you that, yes, God created them according to a plan. If you believe that one creature evolved into the other, you look at the same diagrams and say, yes, one evolved into the other. But there is no proof either for or against evolution in this. In actual fact, people accept evolution on some other basis and then look at such diagrams, and the diagrams convince them even more. 2. Secondly, there is comparative physiology. The book General Zoology states, The tissue and fluid of organisms show many basic similarities in physiological and chemical properties that parallel morphological features. For example, from the hemoglobin in vertebrate blood, oxyhemoglobin crystals can be obtained, their crystalline structure parallels that of vertebrate classification based on body structure. Those of each species are distinct, but all from a genus have some common characteristic. Furthermore, those of all birds have certain resemblances but differ from crystals obtained from blood of mammals or reptiles. End of citation. We can say the same thing here as we said of morphology. If you believe in creation, you say that God made similar creatures with similar blood, and there is no problem. If you believe in evolution, you say that one evolved into the other. A dating system has been devised from precipitations from blood. Scientists see that the precipitations are similar in each species, that they have something in common with one genus, and that they are quite distinct in different genera, birds and monkeys, for example. From this they make certain calculations and decide how many years apart on the evolutionary scale these different creatures are. As it happens, their calculations throw everything else off. If this is to be accepted, other dating systems have to be changed, so it is still controversial. It actually proves nothing, because you can accept it as a proof either of evolution or of God's creation. 3. There is a third argument called comparative embryology. Textbooks like General Zoology used to have pictures that show embryonic fish, salamander, turtle, chicken, pig, man, etc., demonstrating that they all look very much alike and saying that they gradually develop differently. You can see that man has so-called gill slits in the embryo. Therefore, this is supposed to be a remembrance of his ancestry. Footnote. That is, a so-called proof that man evolved from aquatic animals with gills. End of footnote. Ernst Haeckel, in his theory of recapitulation and biogenetic law, stated that an individual organism in its development, ontogeny, tends to recapitulate the stages passed through by its ancestors, phylogeny. Today this theory is no longer accepted by evolutionists. Scientists have found that the gill slits are not gill slits at all, but are just preparing for what is to be developed in the neck of the human being. So this proof has been pretty well discarded. Again, they used the argument that similarity means proof, which in fact it does not. 4. Another proof, which used to be more powerful than it is today, is that of vestigial organs. Evolutionists claim that there are certain organs, like the appendix in man, which seem to have no function now and therefore must be left over from a previous stage of evolution, when a monkey or another of man's ancestors used these organs. But more and more these vestigial organs are found to have a certain use. The appendix, for example, is found to have some kind of glandular function, so this argument is also losing weight. Footnote. Practically all the so-called vestigial organs, especially those in man, have been proved in recent years to have definite uses and not to be vestigial at all. At one time, evolutionists claimed there were about 180 such vestigial organs in man, but practically none are claimed now. Some of these were the thyroid gland, the thymus, the coccyx, the pineal gland, the ear muscles, the tonsils and the appendix. All of these are now known to have useful, and often essential functions, Henry Morris, Scientific Creationism, page 76. For a detailed treatment of this subject, see book Vestigial Organs Are Fully Functional by Dr. Jerry Bergman and Dr. George Howe. End of footnote. And just because we do not know what a certain organ does, this does not mean that it is left over from some lower form of life. 5. Then there are the arguments from paleontology, the study of fossils. Of course, the first seemingly convincing proof is the geological strata, as, for example, in the Grand Canyon where you see all kinds of strata, and the lower you get the more primitive the creatures there seem to be. Scientists date the strata by what kind of creatures are found in them. In the 19th century they discovered these strata and determined which were older and which were younger, and now they have rather elaborate system by which to tell which strata are older and which are younger. Footnote. The geological column scheme devised by evolutionists, with dates assigned to each stratum, is nowhere to be found in nature as a complete set of sediments of standard thickness. It is an imaginary structure that has been synthesized from comparing a stratum of rock in one part of the world with a similar-looking stratum in another part of the world. See Richard Milton, Shattering the Myths of Darwinism, chapters 3 and 7. End of footnote. However, the whole dating system is rather circular. Since often these strata are upside down according to the evolutionary model. Footnote. The Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition admits that in some fields all the strata are exactly upside down, that is, primitive creatures are found at a higher level than more highly evolved ones. End of footnote. They have to make certain readjustments. Just like the Ptolemaic system needed certain adjustments, epicycles had to be devised, because the planets were not going around the Earth uniformly. In the same way, evolutionists must make adjustments when they find that, according to evolutionary theory, the strata are upside down. They have to date them by fossils in them. But how do they know that the fossils in them are in the right order? They know because somewhere else the fossils were in the right, under quotation marks, order according to the evolutionist model, and they got the system from that. If you look at it closely, you see that it is a circular system. One has to have faith that this actually corresponds to reality. There are a number of flaws in this. For one thing, the creatures appear quite suddenly in each strata, with no intermediary types leading up to them. Besides this, as research continues, they are finding animals in the strata which are not supposed to be where they are. For example, now in the Precambrian level they are finding squids-like creatures, Tribraidea, and all kinds of quite complex animals like that, which should not be there because they supposedly did not evolve until some 100 million years later. Either you have to change your idea of the evolution of such creatures, or you have to say that these were exceptions. In general, there is no proof that these strata were laid down over millions of years. Footnote. The uniformitarian assumption that the strata were laid down gradually over millions of years is not borne out by evidence. Modern geological processes show that nowhere today are the rocks being formed anything like those in the existing strata. This points to a catastrophic origin of the strata. See Richard Milton, Shattering the Myths of Darwinism, pages 72-79. And Henry Morris, Scientific Creationism, pages 11-101. End of footnote. The creationists who talk about the flood of Noah say that it is equally conceivable that the flood caused exactly the same thing. The simpler marine animals on the sea bottoms would generally be first to be buried, followed by the fish and other organisms living nearer the ocean surface. The more advanced animals, including man, would be going on higher ground trying to get away from the flood. There would be few remnants of man because man would be trying to get on ships and other things to get away. Footnote. Dr. Henry Morris says further, the fact that, although this order is generally to be expected, it is found to have many exceptions, both in terms of omissions and inversions, is also certainly to be expected in terms of deluge events, but is extremely difficult to account for logically in terms of evolution and uniformity. The Genesis Flood, page 276. Dr. David M. Raup, curator of geology at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History, which houses the world's largest collection of fossils, has made extensive studies of these fossil sequences and has come to the following conclusion. In the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, these have not been found, yet the optimism has died hard, and some pure fantasy has crept into the textbooks. Dr. Raup, who is considered the world's greatest living paleontologist, is an evolutionist, but he acknowledges that one could fit just about any theory one likes to the fossil record. He says that the fossils could just as well have been deposited stochastically, randomly. As far as any order is concerned, David Raup, Probabilistic Models in Evolutionary Paleobiology, American Scientist, January-February 1977, page 57. He even notes the ironic implications of this for creationists. One of the ironies of the evolution-creation debate is that the creationists have accepted the mistaken notion that the fossil record shows a detailed and orderly progression, and they have gone to great lengths to accommodate this fact, under quotation marks, in their flood geology, David Raup, Evolution and the Fossil Record, Science, July 17, 1981, page 289. In other words, writes Dr. Henry Morris, Raup is saying that flood geologists need not bother to work out a flood model for the order of the fossils, since there isn't any order to accommodate. The Biblical Basis for Modern Science, page 363. End of footnote. Moreover, there are only very particular conditions which cause a fossil to be left at all. A creature has to be buried suddenly in a certain kind of mud which allows it to be preserved. Footnote. That is to prevent decay by bacteria or assault by predators. Furthermore, this sediment must be of considerable depth to prevent the remains from being dispersed by natural processes. Richard Milton points out, today there are no known fossiliferous rocks forming anywhere in the world. There is no shortage of organic remains, no lack of quiet sedimentary marine environments. Indeed, there are the bones and shells of millions of creatures available on land and sea. But nowhere are these becoming slowly buried in sediments and lithified. They are simply being eroded by wind, tide, weather, and predators, shattering the myths of Darwinism, page 78. This indicates that the existing fossils were formed as a result of a great catastrophe. See Henry Morris, Scientific Creationism, pages 97-101. End of footnote. The whole idea of the gradualness of these phenomena is being called more and more into question. There is now proof that oil and coal and such things can be made in an extremely short time, in a matter of days or weeks. Footnote. See John D. Morris, The Young Earth, pages 3-102. End of footnote. The formation of fossils itself is very much in favor of some catastrophe. In the realm of paleontology, the most important argument against evolution is that it is hard to say that there has ever been found a single thing which can be called an intermediary species. In fact, Darwin was extremely worried about this. He wrote, "The number of intermediate varieties, which have formerly existed, must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this, perhaps, is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory. The explanation lies, as I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record." End of citation. Today's scientists say that the fossil record is extremely abundant. There are more fossil species known than living species. Still, there have not been found more than a couple which might be interpreted as somehow being an intermediary species. They will tell you about the pterodactyl, a reptile with wings, and say that this reptile is becoming a bird. But why can't you simply say this is a reptile with wings? Footnote. The animal that evolutionists most often cite as a reptile-to-bird transition is actually not the pterodactyl but the Archaeopteryx. Philip E. Johnson calls the Archaeopteryx an odd variant, like the contemporary duck-billed platypus. Darwin on Trail, page 80. Henry Morris points out that it is a mosaic form which possessed no transitional structures. The Biblical Basis of Modern Science, page 341. And even the evolutionists Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldred acknowledge that curious mosaics like Archaeopteryx do not count as smooth intermediates in the fossil record, Paleobiology Volume 3, Spring 1977, page 147. Michael Denton notes that there is no question that this archaic bird is not led up by a series of transitional forms from an ordinary terrestrial reptile through a number of gliding types with increasingly developed feathers until the avian condition is reached. Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, page 176. End of footnote. There are certain fossils called index fossils which, when seen in a certain stratum, determine that that stratum cannot be any older or younger than a certain date, because that animal supposedly became extinct at a certain period. They found a fish. Footnote. The coelacanth, which was discovered in 1938 off the coast of Madagascar. The coelacanth was thought to be closely related to the immediate ancestors of the amphibians. When it was dissected, however, Its internal organs showed no signs of being preadapted for a land environment and gave no indication of how it might be possible for a fish to become an amphibian. Johnson, Darwin on Trail, pages 76-77, see also Denton, pages 157 and 179. End of footnote. They found a fish swimming around in the ocean which was supposed to be extinct 70 million years ago. Footnote. That is, at about the same time that dinosaurs were supposed to have become extinct. End of footnote. Because it was thought to be an index fossil, it threw off the whole thing, and that particular layer which was dated according to this extinct fish was no longer correct. Footnote. There are many other organisms whose fossils had been found only in strata thought to be hundreds of millions of years old, and which were thus used as index fossils, until they were found still living in modern times. For a partial list of these organisms, see Scientific Creationism pages 88 and 89. End of footnote. Why is it that certain species evolve and others stay the same as they were? There are many species found in the ancient strata which are exactly the same as currently living species. Evolutionists have ideas that some are reprobate species that do not go anywhere for some reason, and others are more progressive species since they have the energy to go forward. But that is faith, not proof. The fossil species which have been preserved are just as distinct from each other as are living species. 6. There are the obvious, under quotation marks, family proofs of evolution. In most textbooks of evolution, there are artistic renderings tracing the evolution of the horse and the elephant. There is a great deal of subjectivity involved in this, just as when artists make the Neanderthal man look bent over to resemble an ape. This is not scientific proof but imagination based on one's philosophical idea. There is quite a bit of evidence in the fossil record which is either against evolution or shows that there is no proof one way or the other, and there are some things which are quite remarkable and are unable to be explained by evolution. The few clear, under quotation marks, lines of descent, the horse, the pig, etc., involve either variation within a type, as, evidently, the different sizes of horses, or else, when it involves apparently different kinds of creatures, merely assumes, but cannot prove, that one creature is related to another by direct descent. Footnote. A recent article in World Magazine, July 17, 1999, had noted concerning probably the best known of these alleged lines of descent, the Field Museum of Chicago is the source of that oft-reprinted exhibit purportedly showing the evolution of the horse. Little skeletons are followed by slightly larger and ever more equine skeletons, smoothly mutating until we have the modern-day horse. On the face of it, this seems to provide a vivid visual proof of evolution, with no missing links from the tiny ferret-like creature to the magnificent stallion, and it has been used as such in countless science textbooks. It turns out, though, that the animals whose skeletons are so arranged have nothing to do with each other. They represent different species, different branches, and overlapping times, as even evolutionists, called on the matter by critics of Darwinism, have been forced to admit. The Field Museum, to its credit, has pulled the showcase, substituting a photo of the old exhibit, along with an account of the controversy. Jean Edward Veith, admitting its mistakes. On the supposed lines of descent, see also Denton pages 182-86191, and Milton pages 102-5. End of footnote. If evolution is true, these lines of descent may be plausible, but in no way do they constitute proof for evolution. 7. The final so-called proof of evolution is mutations. As a matter of fact, the serious scientist will tell you that all the rest is not really proof, but the one proof is mutations. There are some evolutionists, such as Theodosius Dobzhansky, who say, "I have proved evolution because I have made a new species in the laboratory. After 30 years of working on fruit flies, which multiply very quickly, you can get the generational equivalent of several hundred thousand years of human life in few decades." Dobzhansky experimented by irradiating fruit flies and finally came up with two which had changes, and which no longer interbred with the other kind of fruit or fly. This is his definition of species, that they do not interbreed. Therefore, he said, I have evolved a new species. In the first place, this was done under extremely artificial conditions, with radioactive waves from outer space in order to justify it. Secondly, it is still a fruit fly and is basically no different from any other fruit fly. It is simply another variety. So he has actually proved nothing. Footnote. Philip E. Johnson notes that an experimenter can greatly increase or decrease the number of bristles in a fruit fly. Or greater reduce the wing size, etc. But the fruit flies are still fruit flies, usually maladapted ones. Some accounts credit the fruit fly experiments with producing new species, in the sense of populations which do not interbreed with each other. Others dispute that the species border has in reality been crossed. Apparently, the question turns on how narrowly or broadly one defines a species, especially with the respect to populations that are inhibited from interbreeding but not totally incapable of it. I am not interested in pursuing the question, because what is at issue here is the capacity to create new organs and organisms by this method, not the capacity to produce separated breeding populations. In any case, there is no reason to believe that the kind of selection used in the fruit fly experiments has anything to do with how fruit flies developed in first place. Darwin on Trail, page 175. For a summary of different definitions of species proposed by evolutionists, see above, page 134. End of footnote. Furthermore, mutations are 99% harmful. All experiments, including those by evolutionists who have worked on them for many decades, have proved unsuccessful in showing any real change from one kind of creature to another, even the most primitive kind that reproduces itself every 10 days. If anything, the evidence in that sphere is for the fixity of species. Footnote. As genetics expert Dr. Lee Spedner has observed, if random mutations could account for the evolution of life, then they must have added a lot of information to the genome from the time of the first putative organism until the appearance of all present life. If this vast amount of information was built up by an accumulation of a long series of random mutations and natural selection, then each of these many billions of mutations must have, on average, added some information. Yet after all the molecular studies that have been done on mutations, not a single one has been found that adds any genetic information. They all lose information. See Dr. Spedner's authoritative refutation of evolution, not by chance. End of footnote. But in the end, we have to say that there is no conclusive scientific proof for evolution, and likewise there is no conclusive proof against evolution, because even though it might not seem too logical or too plausible according to the evidence, still there is no proof that given a billion or trillion of years a monkey might not be produced from an amoeba. Who knows? If you don't consider for a moment what the Holy Fathers say, you might think that perhaps it's true, especially if there is a God. If you think it happened by chance, you have no argument at all. Footnote. In saying by chance, Father Seraphim means without design or without an intelligent designer. According to the Neo-Darwinian modern synthetic theory of evolution, the fundamental mechanism of evolution is chance mutation, acting together with natural selection. End of footnote. To believe it happened by chance requires much more faith than to believe in God. In any case, the evidence we have just examined will make sense to you according to what your philosophy is. The creationist philosophy requires less adjustment of the evidence, and so it is more in accordance with the simplistic presuppositions of modern science. 8. There is one more thing that has been used as a kind of proof of evolution, and that is radiometric dating. Radiocarbon, potassium-argon, uranium decay, and so on. Footnote. The uranium decay system is the first radiometric method used historically, the method against which others have been calibrated, and the main support for the widely accepted idea that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old. End of footnote. These were all discovered in the present century, some of them just recently. Evolutionists say these systems prove the world is really very old. One textbook says they have brought about a revolution in dating, because before we had only relative ideas of age and now we have absolute idea. One can test a certain rock according to the potassium-argon system and come up with the idea that the rock is 2 billion years old. They allow a margin of error of about 10%. The fact of the matter is that the great age of the Earth was supposedly already known, under quotation marks, by scientists long before these dating systems were developed. From their inception, the dating systems were based on unproven uniformitarian presuppositions of Charles Lyell, that the world was many millions if not billions of years old. As William Bean Berry writes in his book Growth of a Prehistoric Timescale, evolution thus is the very basis of the geologic timescale, although the scale itself was erected before Darwin and Wallace presented their system of natural selection to the scientific world. End of citation. It is all dependent on your philosophy. The radiometric dating systems work only if you already know that the world is millions of years old. Footnote. It must be remembered that, scientifically speaking, no one has proof for any dates prior to the beginning of written records, about 4,000 to 6,000 years ago, at most. Dates prior to the beginning of history must necessarily be based on the assumption of uniformitarianism, Henry Morris, Scientific Creationism, page 150. End of footnote. Thus, they are not really revolutionary in dating. They simply fit into an already accepted view. If this new dating systems had said that the world was only 5,000 years old, instead of 3 billion, scientists would not have accepted them so easily. Note. As Richard Milton observes, science has proposed many methods of geochronometry, measuring the Earth's age, all of which are subject to some uncertainties. For example, efflux of helium into the atmosphere, influx of salt to the ocean, etc. But of these many methods, only one technique, that of the radioactive decay of uranium and similar elements, yields an age for the Earth of billion of years. And it is this one method that has been enthusiastically promoted by Darwinists and uniformitarian geologists, while all other methods have been neglected, shattering the myths of Darwinism, page 38. End of footnote. The geological column and approximate ages of all the fossil-bearing strata were also worked out according to evolutionary theory, long before radiometric dating was ever heard of. Footnote. For example, in the 19th century, Charles Lyell attempted to date the end of the Cretaceous period by reference to how long he thought it would have taken the shellfish, whose fossils are found in later beds, to have evolved into their modern descendants. Lyell estimated that the Cretaceous ended 80 million years ago, not far from today's accepted figure of 65 million, shattering the myths of Darwinism, page 22. End of footnote. Any objective scientific book on the subject will tell you that the only way we can give absolute numbers of years to the different strata is by accepting the theory of evolution. Index fossils, under quotation marks, are used as the ultimate indication of the age of the strata, and the age of the index fossils is determined by evolutionary assumptions about them. Footnote. When different radiometric tests of a rock, performed according to one or more radiometric procedures, come up with discordant ages as frequently happens, evolutionists will decide upon an age that accords with their ideas of evolutionary stages of index fossils, under quotation marks, found in the same bed. As Dr. John D. Morris puts it, once again, the fossils date the rocks, and the fossils are dated by evolution. One famous case of this was the dating controversy over the KNMER-1470 skull discovered by Richard Leakey, which is discussed in Appendix 4. See also Lubino, Bones of Contention, pages 247-288, and Milton, pages 53-56. End of footnote. As the American Journal of Science states, the only chronometric scale applicable in geologic history for the stratigraphic classification of rocks and for dating geologic events exactly is furnished by the fossils. Owing to the irreversibility of evolution, they offer an unambiguous time scale for relative age determinations and for worldwide correlation of rocks. Footnote. Likewise, W. M. Elasser of the University of Maryland writes, as is well known, the order of the geological strata is fixed entirely by means of fossils. Thus, the geological method presumes the existence in these periods of living beings of gradually increasing complexity. Encyclopedia Britannica, 1973, Volume 7, page 850. J. E. O'Rourke, writing in the American Journal of Science, January 1976, page 53, states, "The intelligent layman has long suspected circular reasoning in the use of rocks to date fossils and fossils to date rocks. The geologist has never bothered to think of a good reply, feeling that explanations are not worth the trouble as long as the work brings results. This is supposed to be hard-headed pragmatism." End of footnote. Therefore, it's another circular argument. The theory of evolution is not proved by the millions of years, under quotation marks, because the millions of years rely upon the theory of evolution. If evolution is not true, there is no need for the millions of years. Secondly, there are certain basic assumptions which the radiometric dating systems must make. The systems, which trace the decay rate of radioactive minerals to daughter components, require: 1. That there is absolute uniformity, that the decay rate has always been the same for as long as the process has been going on. 2. That there has been no contamination from outside sources, which they admit does happen. 3. That the thing being dated has been isolated, buried somewhere, and no organic matter has been touching it from outside. And finally, 4. That there was none of the daughter component in the first place, but only the parent component. All these things are assumptions. They are not proved. The evolutionist William B. N. Barry writes of the unproven uniformitarian assumptions on which radiometric dating systems, and indeed all aspects of evolutionist geology and paleontology, rely: "All phenomena that are related to the past history of the Earth are dependent upon the principle of uniformity in the nature's processes through time for their interpretation. Everything from interpreting shells preserved in rocks as remains of once living organisms to ascertaining the passage of time by using decay rates of unstable isotopes such as potassium-40 and carbon-14 depends on this principle. For example, the carbon-14 method depends on this principle as expressed in the assumptions that cosmic radiation has been of the same intensity for at least the last 35,000 years, the length of time for which this method is most effective, and that the decay rate of carbon-14 has always been the same as it is now. Obviously, without a principle of uniformity in natural processes, age determinations based on carbon-14 decay could not even be considered." End of citation. Many people, even among non-evolutionists, will admit that carbon-14 is the most reliable of all the dating systems. Even the scientific creationists admit that it has a fair accuracy back perhaps 3,000 years, although with considerable scatter and uncertainty. Footnote. Henry M. Morris, Scientific Creationism, page 162. The reasons why radiocarbon dating has some accuracy up to 3,000 years ago, but not before, are explained on pages 164-67. See also John D. Morris, The Young Earth, pages 64-67. End of footnote. It has been tested on certain articles whose age has been determined, and it has proved to be not too far off in many cases. But beyond 2,000 or 3,000 years it becomes extremely dubious. Even those who are adherents to this system admit that, because the half-life of carbon-14 is 5,600 years or so, it cannot be accurate beyond 25,000 or 35,000 years at the most. The other systems, such as potassium-argon, uranium decay, etc., claim to measure a half-life of 1.3 and 4.5 billion years respectively, and therefore when they talk about proving the age of old rocks they are using these systems. The carbon-14 system is used only on organic matter, and potassium-argon and uranium systems are used on rocks. Footnote. Radioisotope methods cannot be applied to fossils themselves nor to the sedimentary rock containing the fossils, but only to igneous rocks which may lie above or below the fossil-bearing stratum. End of footnote. The same things are true for the latter as they are for the former. There must be uniformity throughout the billions of years, and no contamination from outside. In the potassium-argon method, for example, you must assume that it was all potassium-40 in the beginning before it decayed to argon-40, and all these things you have to take on faith. Footnote. This is a big assumption. Argon-40 is a very common isotope in the atmosphere and the rocks of the Earth's crust. Indeed, argon is the 12th most abundant chemical element on Earth, and more than 99% of it is argon-40. There is no physical or chemical way to tell whether any given sample of argon-40 is the residue of radioactive decay or was present in the rocks when they were formed. Milton, page 47. The argon-40 was present in potassium minerals at the time of their formation is evidenced by the spectacularly erroneous date which the potassium-argon method gives to recently formed rocks of known age. End of footnote. If you try to measure anything recent, say only a million years ago, and try to measure a millimeter with a yardstick, it is not very accurate even assuming it is valid. There have been numerous cases when they have applied this system to new rocks and have come up with ages of millions or billion years. Footnote. For example, the Hawaiian Institute of Geophysics used the potassium-argon method to date volcanic rocks near Hualalai, Hawaii and got ages of up to 3 billion years, when the rocks are known to have been formed in a modern eruption in 1801. Similar rocks formed less than 200 years ago from an active volcano Kilauea were found to give potassium-argon ages of up to 22 million years. 50-year-old lava flows at Mount Ngaro, New Zealand, produced model ages as high as 3.5 million years. See Milton, pages 38 and 47-48. End of footnote. Therefore, the whole thing is very shaky. It requires that those billions of years exist in the first place. Footnote. Dr. John D. Morris explains that radiometric dating, in this case uranium decay method, is based on the assumption that the Earth is at least old enough for the present amount of radiogenic lead, that is daughter component, in a specimen to have been produced by present rates of uranium decay. If we knew that the Earth was old, the possibility exists that radioisotope dating could help to determine exactly how old, but it is useless in testing between old Earth and young Earth, it assumes the old Earth. John D. Morris, The Young Earth, page 57. End of footnote. There are other kinds of tests which have been used at various times as, for example, the rate at which sodium and various chemicals are discharged into the ocean. You measure the amount of the elements there are now in the ocean. Measure approximately how much of it goes into the sea every year, and from that you come up with a guess of how old the ocean must be, and probably the ocean is as old as the world. They did tests with sodium and discovered the world was 100 million years old. But it was found that you get different answers depending on which element you use. Lead gives an age of 2,000 years, others give 8,000 years, some 100 years, some 50 million. There is absolutely no uniformity. There are other tests. For example, a test was done based on the rate at which helium-4 is entering the atmosphere through the corona of the Sun. This indicated that the atmosphere of the Earth is but several thousand years old. Therefore, these tests are very unsure, and some of them make it very dubious that the world could be anything like 5 billion years old. When you come down to it, it depends what your faith is. Some scientists think the Earth is very old because evolution is unthinkable unless the Earth is very old. If you believe in evolution, you must believe the Earth is very old, since it is obvious that evolution does not work on a short time scale. But as far as scientific proof goes, there is none whatsoever that the Earth is 5 billion years old, or 7,500 years old. It could be either. It depends on what kind of suppositions you start with.